Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Office of the Senior Advocate conference call. I would like to introduce Isabel McKenzie. Please go ahead.
Good morning. It's Isabel here, and I'm joined with Dr. Jeff Poss from the University of Waterloo and Dr. Kim McGrail, as well as Rob Cowan Douglas, an economist researcher from our office. The first thing is to let everybody know there's been a small technical glitch with the webinar this morning, and so we're going to allow just a couple of minutes for folks who might have been only accessing through the webinar time to dial into the conference call and download the slides. If you're on the other end of the phone and we're expecting to see the slides through the webinar, I would ask you to please go to the Seniors Advocate website at seniorsadvocatebc.ca. I'll repeat that. seniorsadvocatebc.ca. Look under Reports and Publications, and you will see slides from residential care to hospital presentation. And if you can just download those, and we will tell you when to advance to the next slide as part of the presentation. So I think we'll just give everybody a couple of minutes to do that. Okay, hopefully everybody has now had the ability to download the slides and follow along in the presentation over the teleconference line. And just a reminder to everybody that you can queue up at any point in time to ask a question by pressing 01 on your keypad. We're probably going to take about 30 minutes in the presentation. Both myself and Jeff Poss will be presenting, and then we'll move to questions, and we've allowed a full hour or thereabouts for questions, and Dr. McGrail will join us in answering some of the questions about the study. So, we'll begin. As most of you know, my office released a report on August 1st titled From Residential Care to Hospital, An Emerging Pattern. So the first question you might be asking is, why this report? Well, there are two reasons. First of all, there is almost unanimous opinion in the clinical and research community that hospitalization of frail seniors should be avoided as much as possible. Slide two. We know that hospitalization for seniors increases the risk of infection, delirium, falls, pressure ulcers, deconditioning, anxiety, and death are all elevated for each day a frail senior spends in hospital. There's also much evidence that as many as 50% of hospital visits by long-term care residents are avoidable. So that was one of the reasons. The other reason was that on rounds in emergency departments in six different hospitals in BC, so some were in the interior in the north and some were on the lower mainland and some were on the island, I heard from frontline staff a frustration that some of the care homes in their area, they felt, were sending residents to the hospital for issues and symptoms that could have been managed in the care home by care home staff. And they felt that there was perhaps a waiting on the part of those care homes who are contracted to provide care versus those that are owned and operated by health authorities. So as many of you know, I come from the contracted care sector myself. I've been responsible for the delivery of both contracted home care and contracted residential care. And so I was very sensitive to this issue. But I did believe the clinicians that I spoke with were sincere and that the matter warranted further research. So next slide. We know that past studies have looked at variations on this theme, that the ownership type does influence the rate of hospitalization for residents. Some of them are U.S. studies, some of them are Canadian studies, some of them compared not-for-profits with profits, other compared particular symptoms for admission versus comparing overall admissions. But perhaps most relevant was a study published in the Canadian Journal on Aging, which is a peer-reviewed publication. And this study looked at contracted versus publicly operated care facilities in Vancouver Coastal and looked at emergency department transfers for the period 2005 to 2008. The study had some limitations. It could not look at staffing levels and it could not link to resident acuity, but it was able to adjust for age and sex. And it only looked at emergency department transfers. But within that context and those limitations, it did show a 37% greater likelihood of transfer from the emergency department if the resident lived in a contracted site. With the study completed by my office, we actually were able to link to staffing as well as the characteristics not just of the care facility but of the resident through MDS inter-eye assessments. And in addition to adjusting for age, sex, et cetera, we were also able to look at the whole picture, not just emergency department visits, but also overall hospitalization rates. This provides what we believe is one of the most fulsome studies of this issue. And through measuring different aspects of the hospital experience, there's a built-in check and balance to see if patterns are consistent. So my office gathered the best experts we could find to lead this study. Dr. Kim McGrail is an associate professor at the Center for Health Services and Policy Research at UBC, and she has done many health service research studies related to aging. And Dr. Jeff Poss is an associate adjunct professor in the School of Public Health and Health Systems at the University of Waterloo, and he has published widely on gerontology and health service topics and is considered one of the top Canadian experts internationally on the inter-eye MDS data sets that we used in this analysis. Next slide. So to proceed with this study, we needed to do a review that required both approvals from the Ministry of Health and the University of British Columbia. And from the Ministry of Health, we were required to undergo a privacy impact statement. This looks at whether or not we had the legislative authority to collect and use the data. We also were required to undergo an ethics review by the University of British Columbia. This ethics review required us to submit our purpose for our report, the hypothesis we were going to test, and that hypothesis is whether ownership matters, all else being equal, and we had to submit the proposed methodology for this testing. And to pass the ethics review, we needed to demonstrate the study serves a valid public interest and poses minimal risk to the people who are represented in the data, and this was achieved. Now I want to talk about the data sources. And I would like you to go to either the next slide or it may be the slide after, the one that's labeled data sources. So this report used four data sources, and they are identified in the report in Appendix A and in parts of the body of the report. But the four sources for data that we used, first of all, the Quick Facts Directory, or QFD, from the Office of the Seniors Advocate. This was used to identify the facilities for inclusion, the funded hours of care for each facility, and the type of ownership, whether it was health authority or contracted. And contracted captures both those who operate as a not-for-profit society and those who operate as a private company. The Quick Facts Directory obtains its information directly from the health authorities and from the individual facilities. It is updated annually, and each care facility verifies the accuracy of the information for their facility before it's posted on the website. The other data source we used was the Continuing Care Reporting System, or CCRS. All publicly funded care facilities in BC are required to submit information to the CCRS. This data is submitted to CIHI, where its data integrity is tested and the data is what we call cleaned and is returned to the province. It's in the CCRS reporting system that we were able to get the resident characteristics, which are required comprehensive assessments known as the minimum data set or the MDS. And for those of you who are in the care sector, who are on the line, you will know this basically as what we do from our inter-I assessments. We're also able to get the facility size, whether its status was urban or rural, the facility admission and discharge dates, and the reason for discharge are also from the CCRS. There were 55,130 episodes of care, which includes over 24,000 deaths, and there were 358,470 MDS assessment records used. Next slide. The third source of data was the National Ambulatory Care Reporting System, or what we commonly call NACRS. It is the most comprehensive data reporting on emergency department visits, and it's used by the reporting hospitals that link to 212 out of 293 care facilities and covers 82% of our residents. This data is also submitted to CAHPS and comes back to the province. The research team used the emergency department visit events in NACRS, which includes an urgency triage rating, the date of admission and discharge, the discharge disposition, where the resident went, the presenting problem upon arrival, and a standardized diagnosis. This data was used for the analysis of the transfer to the emergency departments, and only for that particular model. In total, 22,062 records were reviewed, and the time period for review was April 1, 2014 to March 31, 2016. The fourth data source was the discharge abstract data, or the DAD, and it's a reporting requirement for all hospitals, regardless of whether or not they report NACRS, and the data linked to all of the care facilities in the study. This data, again, is submitted to CAHPS, and the DAD data was used for analysis related to hospitalization, so whether or not you were hospitalized, your length of stay, your alternative level of care status, and death and hospital rates. All of those findings relied on both CCRS and DAD. And the time period covered for the DAD data was April 1st, 2012 to March 31st, 2016, so a four-year period of time. And there were 31,727 records reviewed. So in total, there were over 460,000 records reviewed for nearly 50,000 persons as we constructed the analytic data set for this work. Next slide. So using these data, Dr. Poss and Dr. McGrail, or as I think they prefer to be called, and we'll refer to them during the rest of this conference, Jeff and Kim, they set about constructing three models. So model number one was looking at the emergency department transfer. It used the NACRS data and the CCRS data, and it looked at 212 facilities and the time period April 1st, 2014 to March 31st, 2016. The second model they constructed looked at hospitalizations and used the discharge abstract data, the CCRS data, looked at all facilities and looked at the time frame April 1st, 2012 to March 31st, 2016. The second model, and Jeff will speak to that more fully in a few minutes, talked about rates of hospitalization, length of stay, ALC status, et cetera. The third model looked at death in hospital, and it used the DAD data and the CCRS data for all facilities, and again, the four-year period, April 1st, 2012 to March 31st, 2016. The residents excluded from the data review were those who were under 65 years of age, and also we excluded emergency transfers or hospitalizations that occurred during the first 7 days of care in a facility. We recognize that some people are unstable when they are transferred to a facility, and it was not fair to tag a facility with that transfer. And so we felt that using the 7 days cutoff criteria would sufficiently address that. So I'm now going to turn it over to Jeff, who's going to walk through the methodology of the numbers. And we're going to move to slide number 9, which is labeled sources of data used. So over to you, Jeff.
Thank you, Isabel, and good morning. So you should be on the slide that is titled Sources of Data Used. So it's helpful to think about how we use the four data sources that Isabel outlined. Individual residents had a code that was unique to each individual. So we could know for each person when that person was in a care facility, for example, or conditional on being in that care facility when they were transferred to an emergency department or admitted to a hospital. So this is all at the person or individual level. Also, at the facility level, we knew which facility a person was resident in and therefore knew that facility's ownership size, urban-rural status, staffing, and so on. So all four data sources come together in different ways to support the creation of these purposeful analytic data sets that we used in this analysis. So this is an example of using big data and linking it up and creating linked data. One approach in this type of analysis is to take the linked data and produce an analysis that simply tells us what percentage of residents went to the emergency department or were hospitalized or who died in hospital, and then just put them into columns by health authority or contracted sites and so on. This is descriptive types of information, and we certainly looked at this. However, it assumes that all potential differences that might affect these transfers or hospitalizations are the same among facilities or facility types, and that there's no need to adjust or otherwise account for these differences to make them as more fair comparisons. The more sophisticated and scientifically sound approach is to construct the mathematical models such as we use that do take into account these differences and adjust for them. This allows what we commonly refer to as an apples-to-apples comparison. This is an example of this approach to support apples-to-apples comparisons that you may have heard about. You may have heard of the HSMR, or Hospital Standardized Mortality Ratios, that is published in Canada by CIHI, the Canadian Institutes for Health Information, to compare hospitals and how likely their patients are to die during an admission. Because hospitals can differ in the types and risks of patients they admit, these HSMR results are adjusted for things like age, sex, length of stay in hospital, their comorbidities, or the admission status of these individuals. Or you may have heard of this in news reports of seasonal adjustment, such as used by Stats Canada when stating unemployment rates. There's seasonality in the data, and you need to adjust for that to be able to make a comparison from one time period to the next. In the case of this particular study, we know from previous studies that certain factors could influence the use of emergency department, including staffing levels or their staffing complements, the condition of the resident, the age of the resident, the sex of the resident, and so on. We don't necessarily know beforehand what the effect of facility size, whether that facility is in an urban or rural location, or the ownership status has. But we do have these measurements, we have this information, and so we can include them in the model and see if there is, in fact, a significant effect according to the statistics. So for this model, we will talk about three models that were constructed that did contribute results that were central to the report. Two of them are similarly constructed, the ED visits and hospitalization. And the third, around the location of death, is a little simpler and more distinct. So the next slide is slide 10, entitled NACRS Data. I just put this up while I talk about what we did in the preparation for the analysis. So for ED transfer, we took the NACRS data that linked the 212 facilities for which transfer patterns were distinct for NACRS reporting hospitals for the two-year period. We took these events, these ED visits, and adjusted in our models for age, sex, the funded facility care hours as found in the QuickFacts directory, the facility size, a measure of resident acuity that we call CHEST. CHEST is an acronym that stands for Changes in Health, End-Stage Signs and Symptoms of Medical Problems, and its scores come from the resident's most recent MDS or RI assessment. This measure is widely used to understand the individual level risk of that resident's health decline, their risk of hospitalization, and risk of death. And it's used widely in frail and older populations. The adjustment was made using a multivariable proportional hazard regression, also known simply as Cox regression sometimes. The model employed a time-varying covariate approach and treated these adjusters as simultaneous independent adjustment factors, which represent the additional likelihood of the event, the ED visit in this case, when that factor, including contracted ownership, is present, and it adjusts for all other things in the model simultaneously. So if we go to the next slide, this is a chart that came out of the results of this model, and it shows the additional risk or likelihood of a transfer to the ED that is attributable to ownership and other factors. Another way to think about this is that two individuals who are the same and have the same age group, the same sex, the same CHESS score, and the same facility characteristics, but they differ only in that one is contracted and the other one is publicly operated, would be expected to have an additional likelihood of admission or visit to an emergency department. And that additional likelihood attached to contracted ownership was found to be 32%. And you see some other factors in that chart. The thing to keep in mind is that black dotted line represents the hazard ratio of 1, or absolutely no effect. And you do see the confidence intervals around the heights of the bars, which represent things that come out of the statistical operations here, and confidence that we can say that this value is known to be true, and it's not known to be true by chance alone, because there's a certain amount of chance in measurement. So this multivariable type of analysis is an example of that's used widely in epidemiological studies. So, for example, you might want to consider cigarette smoking and lung cancer, which is widely accepted as being truth in health research today. Among individuals included in such a study, you might look at possible differences among smokers and non-smokers, their age, their sex, where they live, their overall health, their physical activity levels, occupations, etc. And then you adjust in models that try to tease out the smoking factor alone, adjusting for these other measures or confounders that may also explain the lung cancer and association with smoking. So this is what we have shown. You can see the other covariates or adjusting variables. You see sex, so male was more likely to visit an ED. You see age, and we've shown as a reference group the oldest group of 95 and over. So among these people 65 and over, the youngest, the 65 to 69, in fact, have the highest likelihood compared to the 95 and overs of visiting an emergency department. You see the contracted red lines. Red line, you see the CHESS, or the health and stability measure, does make a difference. Care hours in this case did not make a difference one way or the other. It was a null finding. And size had a very small, like a 4% increased, so larger size were slightly more, but it wasn't really much to speak of. I'm going to move on to the second model, which dealt more with the DAD data. In a similar way, the DAD data was used for the calculation of hospital admissions. We took the DAD data that linked to all facilities for now a four-year period and used the same Cox regression with the same covariates, except we were able to add one more. In this case, we had enough variation around rural-urban status to use it. It wasn't possible in the ED analysis to adjust for that because there was not enough variation. They were mostly urban facilities. And if you go to the next slide, which is titled Model 2 Hospital Admission, here's our familiar chart now that has the hazard ratios coming out of the multivariate model, the same adjusters, except we now have one more on the right-hand side. And you can see similar types of patterns for, say, male sex and for age groups. And the contracted hazard, or the additional likelihood, if you will, of that hospital admission, if you're in a contracted facility in BC was found to be 34% with the shown level of confidence. So you can it was the red line that that is the thing of interest. But in science, we also are interested in the other factors, and the fact that these things do behave in a way that you expect is both interesting and it puts us in line with other studies and shows that the data are performing. Finally, I want to talk about the third model. You should be on an additional slide that just gives a table of some of the DAD descriptive data while I talk about this. The third model for location of death is somewhat more straightforward, and we weren't required to use time as a factor. So it involved identifying those deaths that could be identified in the combination of the CCRS and the DAD data. So either because the person was discharged deceased from their CCRS episode and was recorded that way, or we saw a death that was recorded in hospital during the stay or within 14 days of the episode ending. So we included all deaths of persons aged 65 and over at the time of death in the four-year period, 2012 to 2016, or 4 years, a total of over 24,000 deaths. To determine if that death occurred in hospital, we looked for which of these were recorded in the discharge deceased records of the DAD, which is a highly precise and highly trusted source of information. The modeling used logistic regression, a simpler type of regression, arguably, than the Cox modeling in the first two models. And it's appropriate for events which are binary, essentially, in nature. So either the death occurred in hospital or it did not. So just among all the deaths that were observed. Next slide, this is numbered 15, titled Model 3 Death in Hospital. So you see the same type of chart. We adjusted for the same factors as the first two models, and this model produced an adjusted odds ratio for contracted ownership of 1.62. You notice this is not hazard ratio as the first two models. It's called an odds ratio, and it's a little hard to interpret because in the real world we don't think about odds. We think about risk or relative likelihood, which is about hazard. Here, the odds ratios, because they're challenging to interpret, we did a conversion so we could represent them as risk ratios, or they could be compared more to the hazard ratios coming out of the first two models. And so that 1.62 odds ratio, which is a weird number to interpret, becomes 1.54, which is quite straightforward, or a 54% higher likelihood after adjustment of the place of death being hospital if that death was for a resident of a contracted care facility. Again, the one other kind of scientific thing of note you may pick up that is look at the CHESS behavior here. So now the higher CHESS scores, the 3s, 4s, and 5s, any of the higher CHESS scores, in fact, above 0, are protective. They mean that there's a lower likelihood of death in hospital, and it's exactly the opposite influence of the person going to hospital or going to the emergency department if you check back on those other two models. And this has to do with the fact that this population, or the sampling, the only looking at deaths, once you know that the person is close to death, which is what the CHESS score does, it actually is a protective factor. And so the people who are dying in hospital, this suggests, are in fact the surprising ones, perhaps, so the ones that you didn't expect to die, and the fact that those are distributed around different types of facilities, we are in fact adjusting for the likelihood of that health instability factor in the location of death. But it's an interesting finding, nonetheless. So the next slide, slide 15 or 16, I guess it is, called Unadjusted Findings. So in addition to the models, we also produced a great deal of descriptive findings that are, in fact, unadjusted. So length of stay, and we talk about ALC proportions or likelihood, or common diagnosis, which we're able to see in both the NAD and the DAD and the NACRS records. So producing adjusted values for these that take into account things that are that may differ across ownership is more challenging than for the three models, and therefore we just provide these as is. And some of them are in the table that you can see. You can, in the first three rows, I just point out the difference between the observed rate. For example, for ED visits was about 29% observed in the for contracted ownership. And once we applied all the mathematics of adjustment, that 29% shifted just slightly to 32%, and so on. So you can see that the adjustment did a little bit more for Model 3. May have to do with the type of event that we're dealing with. It's quite different than the first two, and the modeling is different. So you can absorb that, and some of these numbers are mentioned descriptively in the Office of Senior Advocates report. And just to add one final note about the data, the Canadian Institute for Health Information, or CIHI, manages the CCRS, NACRS, and DAD data that we use. And as Isabel said, they provide a high level of scrutiny and oversight nationally to ensure the data quality is excellent and can be used for reporting to Canadians on their health and health services. But nonetheless, we were vigilant for issues that might threaten the validity of any analysis or findings that we were about here, and some issues were observed. In any data set, you will observe some issues, and we believe we managed them prudently. For example, in about or just under 1% of the episodes of care in BC, we observed that there was an overlap where the person was recorded in two different facilities at the same time. And this is normally seen as being a result of errors in dates, typically where a person is transferred and perhaps that discharge date was late being recorded or was an open date and had to be closed artificially. Here the models took the subsequent admission date, so when we had to assign them to which facility they were in, we took the subsequent admission date as being more reliable and closed off the prior episode's discharge to account for that. So ultimately this affected 1 in 845 days of stay, and so it was too small a source of error to have any significant effect.
Thank you, Jeff, for that thorough explanation of our methodological approach to the study. Maybe we really don't want to know how the sausage is made, but I do appreciate that. So when Kim and Jeff brought me the results of their study, and I must confess that when we embarked on this study, I was a little skeptical that we would find a strong pattern, but that's one of the things you do in embarking on these studies is you are testing a hypothesis. Sometimes it doesn't prove. However, when they brought me the results, I did find them compelling. And I'll get you to move to the next slide, slide 17, to outline the reasons why I found the evidence compelling. First of all, the integrity of the data. As Jeff has highlighted, the data source coming from CIHI, whether it's the NACRS, the DAD, or the CCRS data, it's of high quality. It's the gold standard in Canada. And frankly, there's no other data we can use that we can trust to any greater degree than CIHI data. The ethics review by UBC served as an additional validation, both in terms of the validity of the purpose of our study, the hypothesis we were testing, and our approach, because when you go to the ethics review, you have to talk about what you're going to test, how you're going to test it, and they pass judgment on whether that's going to meet their test or not, and so it did. Second, confidence in the methodology. Jeff and Kim have used standard internationally recognized statistical tools that have been used over the years in literally millions of peer-reviewed studies around the world. Cox regression, all of the kinds of different tools they used are all well accepted and valid. So I was confident that the data was strong, the methodology was strong. The size of the data set, while it's been, I think, 30 years since I've done even simple regression in my graduate studies, I do believe in the law of large numbers. And the size of the data set and the timeline, we examined over 460,000 records for 50,000 residents. We looked at 4 years of data for two of the models, 2 years of data for the other model. And you just simply have to step back and say, this will show a pattern. There's not an anomaly here that's explained by an aberration in one given year or in one setting or with one group of residents. These are large numbers and large data sets. But for me, personally, the most compelling argument was how much the results reinforced each other. First, it found similar results to a previous study that had been peer-reviewed and published in Vancouver Coastal Health Authority, but that only looked at emergency department, and I had some questions about other parts of the hospital experience that might offset that emergency department experience. But two different data sets, three different models, they all produced statistically significant results that showed a consistent pattern that residents from contracted sites were experiencing greater rates of hospitalization, including emergency department. If this study had produced different patterns in the models, I might have been less persuaded. So, for example, if it showed greater emergency department transfer but lower hospitalization, or maybe higher hospitalization but lower length of stay, or lower emergency department transfers but higher hospitalizations, if the results had been mixed up a bit, I might have been entertaining an argument that, well, there's different practices in contracted sites versus health authority sites, but it's really leading to overall similar outcomes as it relates to hospitalization. It's just coming at it from different patterns. But that isn't what the study found. For me, what was most compelling was that at every measure, there was a statistically significant difference that produced higher hospital rates. So you saw the 32% higher rate for emergency department. Okay, well, that was only 212 facilities. It wasn't all facilities, except hospitalization rates, which was all facilities, showed 34% higher rate. And then, of course, the death in hospital, which showed 54% higher rate, which were the three things we were measuring. Within that, there were other little measures. The length of stay, it was also higher. The alternative level of care status, also higher. Now, some of the statistics were, I would argue, quite small. So when we looked at, okay, once they get to the emergency department, what's the difference in admission? It was pretty small. It was 3 or 4%, something like that. And what's the length of stay on ALC as opposed to overall? I think it came in around 8 or 9%. Again, those were small numbers, but they were still weighted toward the contracted sector, so it was consistent. And if the numbers had been switched up a bit, or if the numbers had been lower, if these had produced results, you know, in the single digits, 8-9%, I don't think that would have been compelling. But it was a compelling result when it was presented for me. Now, I've been responsible for the delivery of contracted health services, as I've mentioned before. And so the decision to raise this issue was not made lightly, but the evidence was compelling. And there were so many checks and balances in the data, the methodology, the results, that I just had to sit back, and as much as it challenged certainly my thinking and from my previous life, I had to accept that indeed this pattern does exist. That it cannot be explained by the two most obvious reasons that I would give. If somebody brought these, I would say, well, of course, I care for, my residents are more sick, so they go to the hospital more often, or I have less staff, so of course I can't handle it. But we adjusted for that, the two most obvious reasons. And the pattern continued to be consistent and persistent. So next slide, slide 18. The next obvious step is, well, why? Why does this pattern exist? It's not the obvious. It's not the acuity. It's not the staffing levels. Other possible influences. Well, we know from the research that your level of staffing is one thing, but the complement within that staffing is just as important. And we need to look further. This report cannot answer why it's happening, but it is an important tool in looking and identifying where further investigation is needed. And that further investigation into asking why can then lead us to our end goal, which is affecting the necessary changes to achieve better outcomes. So where do we need to look further? Well, the composition of the staffing. So, okay, we know what the level is. What's the mix of RN to LPN, LPN to carry? Overall hospitalizations, regardless of ownership, have been linked to the complement of the staffing. But we don't know what staff is on duty and how many RNs there are versus LPNs versus carries. And frankly, we don't know that for public or contracted sites. And so we need to go and find out that information and see how it links. We know that continuity of staff makes a difference. We do have a measure of the overall continuity of staff in public sites because we have the HEABC data, but we don't know what it is in contracted sites. We know there's a plethora of studies linking wage rates to job tenure in all fields, not just healthcare. And we know there are a variety of wage rates amongst carries and contracted sites, yet there's a consistent wage scale for health authority sites. We don't have facility level data on wage rates to see if the pattern's more pronounced amongst facilities with lower wage rates and or greater staff turnover. So we need to go and find that information. While the skill level of care aides should be the same as it should be for LPNs and RNs, whether they're in contracted or health authority sites, because all of them care aides are registered and nurses, both practical and registered, are licensed, their experience might be different. Either their experience within their profession or their experience or tenure at that particular facility. Getting to know residents and the facility is important. Many studies link the ability to assess changes in a resident status as changing the trajectory of outcome vis-a-vis hospitalization. But you can't make that assessment if you don't know the baseline. If you don't know what that resident's normal presentation is, you don't know if the symptoms or behavior being demonstrated are normal or abnormal. And so the arguments around the continuity, in addition to the training and the number of staff, is very compelling. What about the allied health professionals? We know that contracted sites have higher rates of falls and fracture, but we also know they have a lower rate of physiotherapy. Are these linked? We don't know. Is there a higher number rate of falls because the population at contract sites is more mobile? And so we need to be careful. We don't want to have unintended consequences of focusing on reducing mobility to the extent where we're putting people who can weight bear and who can mobilize in wheelchairs. So we have to tread carefully in looking at that. What about specialized training and clinical nurse specialist support? Do the overall nursing and allied specialist resources of a health authority compare more favorably to contracted sites? Is there more in-service training and education? We know that contracted sites have a higher rate of UTI in the last 30 days, according to the RI, and we know they have higher rates of hospitalization for UTI. Is this linked to education and training of nurse staffing? We don't know. We've focused on the funding for direct care hours, but have we undervalued the need to adequately resource contracted care providers to provide specialized clinical support and training? That's not reflected in direct care hours, but those nurses and care aides need to have some clinical support through education and resourcing, and we need to make sure our contracted providers are adequately resourced to provide that. What about the do not treat and do not hospitalize orders, which now are most likely found in the medical orders for scope of treatment? There's growing concurrence on the need to integrate more conversations about goals of care with residents and their family members. We currently don't know how many residents in either contracted or health authority sites have a MOST on file. Interestingly enough, in this study, there was 1 year, 2011-12, when the DNT and DNH was included in the RI assessments, and we did look at that. And what was fascinating for me was they were exactly the same for health authority sites as contracted sites. The other thing that was fascinating is it was 25% for both. And is that the right number? Don't know, but we certainly need to do more about making sure we've adequately charted what patients and their families or residents and their families want. And of course, the overarching question of incentives. As uncomfortable as it might be, and as impolite as it might seem to even pose the question, most any economist analyzing this issue would ask how the behavior of the facility, contracted or public, is incentivized to reduce hospitalization. In the U.S., there is strong evidence that when facilities are incentivized to invest in the training and the tools that support better assessment and triage of residents, hospitalizations are reduced. And here in Canada, we know that based on data from 7 provinces, including BC, CHI-HI argues that 24% of hospitalizations for UTI and pneumonia could have been avoided, as the diagnosis, the treatment, and the symptom management was achievable in the facility. So we need to look at how we're resourcing and incentivizing, both contracted and public, around reducing these hospitalizations. So to begin to answer these questions, we need more information. So what are the next steps? Go to slide 19. Over the coming months, over the fall and winter, we're going to be going to facilities and asking, both public and contracted, and asking for more specific information on staffing. We're going to look at the do not hospitalize and do not treat orders as much as we can. We're going to look at staff turnover in contracted and staff wages in contracted and see whether there's any links there. We're going to examine incentive models in other jurisdictions, and we're going to share the data and findings with other jurisdictions. There's quite a bit of interest in this study because of its depth and breadth. Other jurisdictions are interested in replicating it, and that will be helpful because then we will be able to compare whether in BC something is different than in Ontario or Alberta or New Brunswick, and so that will be very helpful. And all of this, we have to remember, final slide, slide 20, is that the goal of all of this is the best of care possible for seniors living in long-term care. And we know we can increase that by decreasing unnecessary hospitalization, by supporting seniors to remain in what is their home, the long-term care facility, for optimal end-of-life care. So now, final, I guess, the 21st slide, question and answers. We're pleased to open it up, and probably it'll be Kim and Jeff answering most of the questions. So over to you.
Thank you. As a reminder, over the phone, you can queue up to ask a question by pressing the numbers 01. To withdraw your question, you can press the pound key. And we do have a question on the phone there. And the first question on the phone, over the phone, is from Errol Hastings. Please go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. I had a question about some of the data, particularly in the admissions. The report states that 75% of residents are admitted to hospital are first seen in the emergency department, while 25% are not seen in the emergency department, but admitted directly to a hospital bed. Says that most of these direct admissions, almost 90%, are elective or planned. The number of 25% of admissions being admitted directly to hospital without being seen in emergency and 22.5% of admissions being pre-planned and elected seems very high. I've talked to at least 15 people in my home and in different other homes, and we all believe that that number should be definitely under 10% and probably under 5%. Now, when I looked at slide number 12, I see that the health authorities have 34% direct admissions and the contracted homes have 24% direct admissions. When you do the quick math, if I've done it right, and add those admissions in rather than exclude them, we actually see that the health authorities have used slightly more hospital admissions per resident, almost identical, but I think slightly more. My question would be, why is the number so high in terms of 27% overall? Why is there such a gap of 34% to 24%? And is there, frankly, an issue with the data? Because we don't send people for pre-planned hospital admission, almost never in our homes.
I think I'm going to let Jeff answer that question now.
Thank you. You know, it's I'm not sure I understood all the fine points of the numbers. I'd have to go back and trace through your arguments step by step. But what I can say is that this is what the DAD says. There are two codes that we use. The one was for any of the DAD hospitalizations. Was that person admitted through an emergency department or not? That's one. The other was, what type of admission was this, independent of how they came in? Was this considered to be an elective entry, or was it considered to be an urgent or emergent type of admission? So these are two independent things. So the first proportion that you talk about, the admission from emergency department, that is in fact 73%, what we saw among all the hospitalizations. And then apart from that, we looked at the proportion that were elective, purely elective, and that is, and that's independent of the first. There are some electives that come in through the emergency department. That is a thing you will see in the data. But the elective proportion was, again, right around 23-24%. You know, to suggest that these are somehow sort of wrong or not reflective practice, I don't know how to respond to that. All I'm saying that the DAD is highly vetted. If in fact it's helpful to do some case analysis or to understand, you know, who are these people, in the end, what we focused on for the bulk of the analysis was was the urgent emergent proportion. Okay, and Kim, you've got even a better answer than my round.
Yeah,
these surgeries.
If they were admitted as part of that protocol and they had a DAD, we do have some people that have zero length of stay. They're admitted and discharged on the same day, and those would be included, but as part of the elective proportion.
Okay, so bear in mind that because day surgery is part of the DAD data collection system, if people are sent over to the hospital for a scope procedure that requires an outpatient stay, a day surgery type of stay, or that sort of thing, that's going to count as a planned elective admission and would be included in that statistic and then excluded from our main analysis.
Yeah, it might help, Errol, to understand, first of all, the DAD data are highly reliable data, and just to remind everybody of the law of large numbers, of the number of assessments we're talking about here. But one actually would expect to see residents from care homes hospitalized for elective procedures. Those were excluded from this study. And so an example of that is, as Kim said, you might need endoscopy, but the big thing is the cataracts. And so we do have residents in care homes who are admitted for cataract, and that's appropriate. And so I think that's what you're seeing in the numbers, Earl.
It's not saying we don't have them admitted. We see in a 100-bed home, we see one resident go for cataract surgery a year. That's about our rate. And again, it's just radically different than what I would see the reality to be, even including day surgeries. I just don't see the number being correct, and I think it needs examination. I did hear by the grapevine when I was talking to somebody about this that in the past some emergencies started admitting everyone because of funding issues. And so I don't know how that affected the DAD or if it did, but I guess what I would also say is if there are future surveys, if we could get them ahead of the release to be able to say, you know, as industry experts, that number doesn't make sense. Because it's one thing to say data is good and then look at it, but if you're on the front line and knowing, you know, how you send out your residents and what it looks like, how often they come back, how often they're admitted, we could have pointed out some of this and maybe some further investigation could have been done.
Well, I think the caution I would raise is that all of us will have experiences with our own home that may not reflect the norm. So if we look, for example, at antipsychotic use, there are care homes whose antipsychotic use without a diagnosis is very low, 10%, and there's other homes where it's 50%, and yet we talk about what happens overall. So I think we need to understand a little, and I had hoped we would achieve that in this discussion around explaining this this data. The data are going to be more reliable than the anecdotal reportings of individual facilities. We can't deal in, well, this is my experience, and extrapolate that to be everybody's experience. That's why we embark on the scientific approach that we've done in looking at this issue through through this study. So I think, Errol, if you continue to have questions, maybe connecting directly with Jeff and Kim will help you understand a little bit more what we've done. So, but thank you for raising those issues. And if we have another question out there.
Thank you very much. The next question is from Paul Sibley. Please go ahead.
Thank you. One of the thoughts that came up for me is that I make an assumption that, if I accept the data that there's a pattern there that's identified, I'm wondering if there's a cohort of contracted agencies that don't reinforce the pattern. They're exceptional to the pattern. And if looking at those, if there is a cohort of those, and looking at them through the lens of some of the suggested reasons why, does that cohort inform understanding this pattern that when compared to the health authority organizations?
Paul, you raise an excellent question, and it's like you've been in on the discussions on how we're going to approach this next. I'm going to let Kim answer this. We do have a distribution through a histogram, but just to remind everybody listening on the phone that these are likelihoods, and that there are some care facilities that are, as you say, exception to the pattern, both positively and negatively. So I'm just going to let Kim speak to it. I think we've pulled the histogram out.
It's a great question, and as well, I actually started providing a really excellent answer, which of course is that underlying, so what we find when we do this kind of regression analysis is a kind of point value for a difference overall between these two groups, but underlying that point value is a distribution in both groups. And so what the point value suggests is that those distributions don't overlap completely, that there is some distinction between them. But of course, that doesn't mean that every home in a contracted site performs the same way and every home in a non-contracted site performs a different way. There's going to be some overlap. And so we've started having some discussions about trying to pull out the places that seem to be at one end of that distribution or the other, and to try to see, I think as you're describing nicely, is there a group of homes that seems to have a better than predicted or better than expected outcomes or worse than expected outcomes, and can we learn something about the potential causes of these differences from that more in-depth investigation of a few select places?
Yeah. And that's exactly one of the next steps we're going to be taking, Paul, when we get some of this information in.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next question is from David Chepedak. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about this report. We have quite a few questions, but we'll just narrow it down just to a couple questions and comments. The question would be, is a confidence interval of between 27 and 35% for some of the models that seems low? So we'd like be interested in your comments on that, if that's a very low confidence interval level. But more importantly, just going to the conclusion of the report, as is obvious from discussions about the methodology and the many factors that are very complex that could be impacting this issue, the report does say, kind of on page 9, why are contracted facilities underperforming, which seems to imply a conclusion. And then the second paragraph talks about what is it about the culture of contracted care homes. I think that's also problematic. It appears to be moving towards a conclusion, but I think it's far too early, to move in that direction. And I'll bring up just one specific issue. In this report, there literally isn't one word about physicians. And the timing of the data that you've used is important because the RCI really got underway in the last 2 years and has had a significant impact on giving care homes, particularly for smaller care homes, more consistent, timely access to physician coverage. And we all know that that is a critical component of whether a person is admitted to emergency and ends up transferred to emergency and ends up being admitted. So I would imagine, I would almost guarantee that data would look incredibly different when we see what's happened in the last 2 years. And yet the issue of physician coverage isn't even mentioned, and it could have a significant causal impact on the data. So that would just be one example of a kind of question that we would have about the report and a concern about where future research might go if there are some kind of suggested conclusions already in mind. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. I'll turn it over. I'll let Jeff, first of all, speak to the confidence interval, and then I'll speak to the other issues that you raised. So, Jeff?
Well, pretty straight up, a confidence interval in that range doesn't surprise me at all. This is a large data set. Lots of different measures used, and it has to do with the confidence intervals tend to come out of two things: the size of the data set that you're looking at, and the variation in the measures in the individual measures that are all going on there. And you know, based on other studies, other models I've produced and looked at, having a confidence interval where the point value is in this case 1.32 for the ED, it goes from 1.27 to 1.37. It's not surprising to me at all. Kim, I don't know if you.
Yeah. Okay, so hopefully that's the techies out there are satisfied with that. In terms of the comment on the report, the conclusion is the when you look at the results of this study and you look at these numbers on the issue of hospitalization, the contracted sites are underperforming relative to the health authority sites. They are, the pattern does exist. Does that mean that every facility is underperforming? No. But in aggregate, remembering the hypothesis that was being tested, which is, does ownership matter? That would appear to be proven with the results of the study. In terms of the query about what is it about the culture, I think that is a relevant question to ask, because you have to remember that we have, through the modeling, held constant for a whole bunch of variables, not all, variables that we can. And so the literature would support part of the posing or hypotheses about the culture. I don't think it's going to drive necessarily the further research. I think the approach we're going to be doing is to try and test the objective variables as much as we can. Culture is a subjective variable. I mean, how exactly, but being able to look at things like continuity and staffing complements, and those are more objective. The question about physicians, it's unclear when we actually look system-wide at what the practical effect of these physicians has been, that it has actually played out on the floor, if you will, to the extent that some of the narrative concludes its impact is. But we are certainly able to measure that. In fact, we have had a discussion. We've just wrapped up the end of 2017-18 data. And measuring 1 year is a bit problematic, but we can go now and measure 2 years. So this data that we used concluded in 2016. So we can now look at the 17-18 data. We think we can do it relatively quickly if we use exactly the same process we used here. We've got the reviews and protocols in place, and we can test that, David, around whether there's a difference. And if there is a significant difference, we will report out on that.
Thank you very much. We do have three more questions here on the queue. The next one is from Faye Jones. Please go ahead, Faye Jones.
Hi, thank you. Just a really quick question in talking about the DAD data. Was this including surgical daycares and inpatients or strictly inpatients?
The initial assessment of the DAD data included the surgical daycare and inpatients, but the main analysis was restricted to people who had unplanned admissions, which would effectively eliminate virtually all of the surgical daycare admissions.
Okay, thank you.
So I think the layperson's explanation is that is we got everything in. And then when we looked at this, we took out those admissions that we would consider to have been planned, which would be people going in for diagnostics and day surgery. Those were taken out before the models were run.
Thank you very much. The next question is from Donna Wunderlich. Please go ahead.
Oh, okay. Hi, it's Donna, and you've just answered my question. I was going to ask about the potential for a future look around the impact of the RCI and the support of our physicians in residential care. So I will save the time and pass it on to the last question.
Thanks, Donna.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you want to ask a question, you can press 01 on your dial pad, and if you want to withdraw your question, you can press the pound sign. The next question is from Bob Green. Please go ahead.
Hi, Elizabeth. I have a question about, well, first of all, I want to comment about the comment in the study that says that the contracting sector is underperforming. I think the inference there and the assumption is that the model is what's happening in the owned and operated sites. And I don't think anybody has done anything to prove that that is the model against which anybody should be compared, and therefore to say underperforming in the contracted sector may be not quite stating it. The other question I would have is the actual numbers. So we compare the contracted facilities to the owned and operated facilities, and there's a percentage difference. There's a number of reasons why that may be. One of them is that a lot of the contracted facilities the owned and operated facilities are on the same site, and we do know that they have the ability, when they want somebody out of the hospital, to put additional staffing in there and to move them out more quickly. Contracted sites do not have that ability, and you'll often see, having run a contracted site, there's been times when we've had a lot of pressure put on us by the health authority to take somebody back, and we say it is not safe, and we can't take them back, and we understand the pressure on emergency, but it's not safe to take them back. And so that may be one of the things. But in the total numbers, using the numbers in the study, says there's 13,500 visits to emergency from seniors care homes. And if you look at 28,000 residents, that equates to a total of 37 residents a day on average that will visit an emergency from a care home. And if you have 28,000 residents, that means 1.3 of every 1,000 residents will visit from a contracted site, will visit an emergency each day. I would almost look at those numbers and say, what a good job the residential care sector is doing of keeping people out of emergencies. Not to say we can't do better, but I think that this report has created a level of fear that there's this terrible job going on in the contracted sites, and when in fact people in residential care may have a far higher chance of not going into emergency compared to people of the same age in the community. I don't know what the numbers are, how many people 75 and over of the 596,000 seniors in BC over the age of 70 go to emergency. So it's the appropriateness of the assumptions that are being made and the total numbers. Comparing percentages can make things look an awful lot worse than they are compared to the real data. And is that really a significant issue to be looking at?
Well, Bob, my friend, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this, I guess. So to answer the first question, I think that my job as the seniors advocate is to look at issues related to seniors independent of the interests of the providers of the care, the funders of the care, or the policymakers. And so the question is the issue of unnecessary hospitalizations, potentially unnecessary hospitalizations, of seniors from care homes a relevant enough issue? And people out there will have their own opinions about whether these numbers are significant or not. I think they are sufficiently significant. I'm not the only one who thinks that. I just was on a conference webinar yesterday morning with the Canadian Frailty Network looking at this very issue on a pan-Canadian perspective around unnecessary hospitalizations of seniors, frail seniors from care homes. And their data, and there's the folks out there choosing wisely, where they're saying up to 50% of these hospitalizations, and that's in total, so it counts both a trip to the emergency department and or a hospitalization, is unnecessary. And there's growing medical evidence around how it's not, in fact, beneficial if it's unnecessary. And, in fact, we need to look at what we can do better in our long-term care settings around both assessing, diagnosing, and treating for things we have been transferring to the emergency department. The issue of resources is a relevant question, and I would ask that the industry consider that one of the possible outcomes of all of this is that more resources will be allocated to contracted facilities around things that are not captured necessarily in direct care hours. So things like in-service training and education. We don't know. We don't know where all of this scientific inquiry is going to lead us. But I think that while I think it's a perfectly legitimate position to take that this is not a significantly big enough issue from your perspective, I'll respect that. That's not my perspective, and you'll have others who share yours, and I'll have others that share mine. And I think what we need to do now is we need to focus, or at least I'm focused now, on the end goal. And the end goal is we need to try and make the quality of care for seniors in our care homes the best that it can possibly be. There are many, many things that contribute to quality of care. This is one of them. It's not the only thing. But it is one where we do see a pattern amongst a group of care providers, and we are looking at the characteristics that are distinct and whether those are influencing this pattern, and if they are, how we can remedy that. Because I do believe that unnecessary hospitalization does impact in a negative way quality of care, and I do think we need to do a better job about end-of-life care in long-term care facilities, and I don't think I'm the only one who thinks that. And certainly the death in hospital data is speaking to what do we need to do more of to support end-of-life care in our contracted sites. Resourcing might be part of that. So just as you talk about the resident who, or the care facility that's understaffed and can't take a resident back from the hospital, I can also provide anecdotal stories of care facilities who do get temporary increases in their staffing to deal with higher acuity. I've seen those negotiations around we need to return this person and the care facility saying I need extra staffing to address this, or I'm dealing with an outbreak of influenza and I need extra staffing. So it's not just in the public facilities. And the public facilities don't always get the additional staffing. The public facilities do care for higher acuity residents, as evidenced in the CHESS scores and the MAPLE scores. And so that's not to say that the issues in the contracted care facilities are not real. They are, and we know that contracted facilities are understaffed relative to public facilities, all else being held equal. And so we're very pleased that this office was able to help move that work forward around getting that that inequity corrected. And perhaps this will lead to better resources as well. But I think I'm not questioning the data. I think questioning discharge abstract data and NACRS data and CHI-HI data and questioning, 400,000 chart reviews as not being able to pick out a pattern, I've moved beyond that. I was skeptical about the results of this study until I saw the results. And they were compelling. I don't think the numbers are small. So, you know, we're moving on. We're going to try and find a way to find out what causes are, because you can't fix the problem until you know what's causing it. We know there is a problem. We don't know what's causing it. We need to find that out and then find out how we can fix it. And I would hope that the care industry and individual care providers would join in that quest for a better understanding. So I don't think, are there any other questions out there?
Oh, there's actually 6 more questions.
Okay, I think we're scheduled to go for a little longer, so we're happy to take more questions.
Great. The next question is from Algina. Please go ahead.
Madam Senior Advocate here. So how do you account in your study for the geographical location of public versus private care homes? So most of the public care homes are, in fact, extensions of public hospitals, right? So Burnaby Hospital has its extended care units. And many of those public beds are, you know, additions or extended care units of hospitals. The private care homes, whether nonprofit or privately owned, when they were being developed, especially under Gordon Campbell's 5,000-bed strategy, was to build the homes in residential areas. The idea was to move away from the institutional buildings, away from hospitals, and closer to where the residents' families live, so that the families could visit more often. So that was the bargain, that private operators would build homes closer to where the families lived. But then when we would need additional support, we would be able to send residents to hospital when needed, because we may not have the supports where we have in place. So is there, the study is sort of, is there a way that you can account for the difference in geographical location of public and private homes?
Well, Jeff and Kim are conferring on how to answer this, but one of the things I do want to correct, Al, is the majority of public beds are not actually attached to the hospital. The majority of public beds are in freestanding locations.
But they're on the grounds of, close to hospitals.
No, they're not on the grounds either. So we did look at when they're actually integrated into the hospital and when they're on the campus of care with a hospital, and then when they're independent and away from the hospital. So the majority are independent. That's the first thing. The other thing is we were able to look at urban-rural. Now, we were not able to look at it for emergency departments, but we were able to look at it for hospitalizations and death in hospital. I'm going to turn it over to Jeff, but my recollection is it was the opposite, that in fact it was higher in urban areas and lower in rural. So Jeff, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, that's what we found as the overall effect was an urban facility compared to a rural facility was close to 40% more likely to have a hospital admission, all else being adjusted for. That's not necessarily the absolute measure of location, but we were able to adjust for that in the models. In addition, though, we did look at some things that did not make it into the report that we look at on the side of our analysis. We did break it down to the types of health authority-run facilities and looked at those, as Isabel said, that are hospital-attached or hospital-co-located versus those that are independently located or not part of a hospital organization. And they make up, as Isabel said, the majority of the health authority operated beds. And when we do that breakdown, your sense of it is that, yeah, there should be some effect from the hospital attachment or co-location, and there is a small effect. But however, we found that the health authority owned that were independent facilities were still distinct from the contracted facilities overall across the province, again, even after you adjust for the urban-rural status.
And if you were co-located on the site, you would still trigger an admission through NACRS or DAD, if you went into either the emergency department or a hospitalization.
The follow-up question I have with public versus private is that most of the public care homes that exist, their overheads are carried by the health authority, right? They don't need a payroll person. They don't need to have that. And so they are able to dedicate most of their funding towards care, whereas the private care homes have a different scenario. Have you been able to account for that in your data?
I'm not sure that's quite correct, Al.
So
I know.
If you have a health authority, if you have a payroll of a public care home, authority that covers it. And if they need HR assistance, they rely on the health authority's provision, and that's it's sort of off the books that they get that support. They don't have dedicated office people to
no, but Al, the payroll clerks aren't doing the bedside care.
Is that the dollars of funding that public care homes receive can be more can be allocated towards bedside care as opposed to in private care homes?
Doesn't work that way when the public care homes are allocating their staffing. So their staffing is their staffing, and we have their direct care hours, and that is what they staff to. Now, the point that was raised by one of the previous speakers around additional staff for surge or particularly difficult clients applies to both the private and the public. But I don't think that issue actually is relevant to this discussion. It's the care hours are the care hours, whether they're public or contracted. Is there another question out there?
Thank you very much. We do have actually six more questions here. So the next one is from Allison Leamy. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there, Isabel. Just a question about the difference between men and women in your three models.
That is an interesting observation that men are more likely. Now, as you know, that was adjusted for when we produced the models testing the contracted hypotheses. But you'll see that I think it's also interesting that younger are also more likely to be hospitalized. We think what we're finding there, and I'll maybe let Kim speak a little bit more to this, but you might be seeing more of your more hot, younger, but yet highly physically fragile, quadriplegic, dependent male population.
Yeah, this is all speculative, of course, because this is a finding that is quite interesting and not entirely obvious, particularly because the male effect you're seeing there is, as Isabel said, adjusted for those other things, but it may well relate to the fact that men do tend to be younger. They tend to have different kinds of conditions,
yep.
But there may be something of a sex or gender bias going on that is worth investigating a bit if there's more aggressive treatment for males it is all completely speculative at this point, but it is a really interesting finding that I agree deserves a bit of further investigation.
It is part of, there is a wider discussion out there about is there gender bias in the medical, regardless of whether you're in a care home or the population at large. So it's a good question.
Thank you. The next question is from Donna Gulp. Please go ahead.
Hello. I've really enjoyed this last hour. I've learned so very much. And the last comment that was made on those slides was to stay in our homes. So I just had to call and make one comment. We all want to stay in our home. We do love our homes, but we can't. So I trust that someone is looking for a ways and means for us to be able to stay in our home.
Well, thank you, Donna. And of course, that was in reference to the home being the care home for the people. But you're quite right. Before we get to the care home, we want to stay in our home. And in fact, my office is working on, there's a couple of things we're working on, a home support report and also a report about some of the financial tax incentives that are aligning or not aligning to support seniors at home. And certainly you're correct. That's what most people want, and we are working on that. But thank you for that comment.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The next question is from Tim Orr. Please go ahead.
Hi, Isabel. Appreciate the opportunity to understand this report better. I have a couple of questions. Firstly, do you have health authority-specific data that you could make available to us so that we could try and reconcile with some of the data that we have? Secondly, just wondering if you have been able to identify residents or patients coming from private facilities, if they were from a funded bed or a private pay bed. My impression is that some of the private pay beds are staffed and operated quite differently and may have quite different results. So just wondering if you're able to get that level of specificity with the residents coming from contracted beds. And the third one is, I'm looking at slide 14, and, you know, the number admitted to hospital from the emergency department or through the emergency department, I'm assuming, health authority 65%, all contracted 76%. Just wondering, what assumptions are you making? Like, what is that data telling us? If a facility, regardless of ownership, sends someone to the emergency department and they're subsequently admitted to hospital, is the assumption that that was a justified appropriate visit, or that the hospital admission was inappropriate as well as the presentation to the emergency room?
So I'm going to try and answer these in order. So first question was, do we have health authority level data? Jeff, I'm going to turn that to you.
We have the descriptive tables, and I think they're in the process of sharing those out. We've not run the three models stratified by health authority, and it may not always work because especially in the northern health authority, you don't have all ownerships represented very well. It's a skewed sample. But we will have a look at that. But in terms of the descriptive side, which is probably, you know, what you're looking at anyway, if you want to compare your numbers to ours, we will have something to share through the office shortly.
And then the next question about private versus contracted. So first of all, the inclusion criteria was you had to be listed in the Quick Facts directory. Only facilities with publicly subsidized beds are listed in that directory. So a totally private facility is not listed and is not part of this study. The next question was whether notwithstanding that it's a publicly subsidized facility, is it 100% of the residents? You had to be in the CCRF system to be included, which means you needed the RIE assessment, and the private pay residents are not systematically in that system. So I would say that no, they aren't included. I'm looking at Kim to see if it's possible a private could slip into that data set.
It's possible, but it's
unlikely. And if it did happen, Tim, the numbers would be so small, given the large numbers we're dealing with here, that it would not influence the outcome. Now, was there a fourth question, or was that it?
It was about hospital admissions that came.
Oh, right. Thank you very much. Yeah. So that is a question to which there is not a straightforward answer, and about which I suspect there is debate. And so one of the streams of thought out in the clinical community at the moment is the reason the trips to the emergency department and the hospitalization is unnecessary is because it could have been diagnosed and treated in the care facility. There's two issues here. There's upstream, you know, is there not proper symptom management at the beginning, and so it escalates, and requires a trip to the hospital and could have been prevented, or could it have been treated in the facility? And certainly, I think I am in the school with many other people who believe it's not absolutely black and white, but there definitely will be people who present at emergency department for whom, given what they are presenting with, it is legitimate to admit them, but that they still could have been treated for that in the care facility. Pneumonias and UCIs, I think, is what CHI-HI is focusing on the most, and they're saying that 24% of hospitalizations for UCIs, now this is pan-Canadian data, they're saying that 24% of the admissions for UTI and pneumonia actually could have been treated, could have been properly diagnosed and treated given the expectations of staffing, the 24-hour nursing staffing in care homes. So it's not a definitive answer because it is an answer about which there is debate.
Thank you very much. We do have three more questions here. The next one is from Errol Hastings, his second question. Please go ahead.
Hi, just a quick follow-up question on earlier. I had mentioned, and perhaps I wasn't clear enough, the difference in terms of direct admissions, 34% for health authorities and 24% for contracted facilities. Are we aware of any reason for this discrepancy, and is it a potential data flag, and if data quality flag, and if it isn't, is there going to be work done to look at how health authorities are using hospital resources for pre-planned admissions?
It's Isabel here, Errol. I think I'm not going to say that pre-planned admissions are unnecessary. And I think, so when you ask the question are we going to be looking at this? As the seniors advocate, I am certainly not going to be saying that seniors aren't entitled to cataract surgery or endoscopy or the other kind of investigative procedures and treatments that might come from a planned admission. As to why is there the discrepancy between the planned admissions between contracted and non-and health authority, it was not part of this study because we're focusing on potentially avoidable or unnecessary hospitalizations and we're not saying that planned is unnecessary or avoidable. In fact, it's the opposite. Kim is welcome to weigh in on this as well, but I can tell you what my first thought is, one of the reasons why it might be, is that health authority owned and operated sites do care for higher acuity residents, and so they might be more needing of some of these diagnostics or procedures. I don't know why that reason, Errol, but as I say, it's not, our position is that those are not unnecessary.
Yeah, and I will just add that those are unadjusted numbers, as Isabel said. Those are not things that we took into account, the different mix of patients in those different types of facilities, but probably more importantly, because it wasn't the main focus of the study, it's not something that we delved into at all. So is it a data flag? I don't think it's a data flag because both these people are going to hospitals, and you would have to have some underlying reason to believe that there were different recording systems in place for people coming from contracted versus non-contracted facilities, which doesn't really make any sense. So it's not a flag.
The admission clerk at the hospital is treating everybody they admit the same. They're not saying, oh, you're from a health authority site, and so I'm going to use a different form to admit you. In fact, they don't even use a different form if you walk in off the street. So I don't think it's a data flag.
Thank you very much. The next question is from Ali Devji. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Isabel. Thank you for taking the time to go through the data with us. I just had a couple questions that may be simple compared to some of the other ones. First question was that I noticed that in the model number one, there was hazard ratios that correspond to care staff levels of greater than 3.11 care hours, direct care hours per resident per day. Is there any possibility to drill down further and see the hazard ratio for care staff greater or equal to 3.36 direct care hours per day? And my second question was, and it may have been already explained, but I apologize if I didn't pick up on it. Does the CHESS scores or hazard ratios take into account the CHI-HI indicators and QI data, such as restraint use of antipsychotics, percent of residents with dementia, or does it take into account any of the outcome indicators that come out as the input from the MDS?
So I'm going to let Jeff answer the care hour question.
Yeah, thank you. The short answer is that we did look at different cut points, and we settled on this 3.11 because it represented the median. Is that? Yeah, I'm looking at Kim. The median, which is giving us the most power to see an overall difference. So to answer the question, do higher staffed beds perform differently than lower staffed ones? And that allowed us to see this as powerfully as possible. Whether there's a cut point that that answers the question, what is the optimum staffing, or are there different levels? We don't quite have enough power to be frank. A lot of the staff hours kind of settle in the same ranges, so there's not as much variation. You're kind of stuck in different classes as you go through the numbers, and so we can't really see, we don't have the sensitivity to be able to see some of this in the current models.
And I think, Allie, that it's important to remember that when we're looking at the contracted, where there is distinctly lower funded care hours, direct care hours, than the owned and operated, that was adjusted for, so it treated it as though it was equal. So it is washed out. In terms of the other QI, I'll let Jeff speak more, but what we were testing here was frailty. Some of the issues you raised, like restraint use and antipsychotic use, is not necessarily related to the frailty, but it could be caught in the CHESS score that's measuring frailty. And so the question that we really wanted to answer here was, are you seeing this pattern because a certain group of care homes, contracted or health authority owned and operated, are caring for more frail people? And so we looked, you had to measure the frailty, and we used the CHESS score. But the other thing that's interesting, and I can let Jeff talk to all of those adjustments, but you know, whether you use CHESS or case mix index, or I think even MAPLE 4 or 5, right across the board, the health authority owned and operated sites do actually care for more frail and complex residents. So you might argue you would expect to see more hospitalizations from them, and we saw less. But I'll turn it over to Jeff to talk about the CHESS and the frailty.
Yeah, thanks, Isabel. The CHESS score was selected as the best available adjuster for, call it frailty, call it health instability. I mean, health instability is probably the label that fits best. And what we want to know is, are these people's health likely to change? Is it especially changing on the downward trajectory, whereby hospitalization, the need for more, both more physical but also more medical care, and ultimately death is higher among people with higher CHESS scores. The thing with adjusting other outcomes like antipsychotics or falls is that you tend to pick the adjusters that are both clinically important and understood to affect that outcome, but also that have found to have an association in the data. In the case of CHESS and the exact outcome that we're seeing, both a death and the mechanism around how people die and where, as well as hospitalization and health decline, CHESS is the go-to standard. While there are always other things that you could add in, CHESS does, allude to this, that once you have a measure of some of the things that are going on in the health of a frail elderly person, There are many other things that you're also sweeping up at the same time. So there's an ADL decline, there's an overall decline, there's an end-stage disease item, there's weight loss, there's edema, all these kinds of symptoms that themselves are also reflective of other things that may be going on with that resident. So it's a pretty good measure for what we're trying to do with it here, which is to allow for differences in these cared for populations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the last question that we have on the queue here is from Sue Evans. Please go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Thanks, Isabel, for holding the session, and to Jeff and Kim. It has been really informative. Thanks so much. I've got a couple of questions. One is, Isabel, I think you started to answer it. This is with respect to the physicians. A lot of the data, the stuff from the NACRS and DAD and all of our data sources, they're all really, most of the decisions are physician-driven after they leave the care home. So the length of stay is determined by the physician in the hospital. The admission is determined by the physician. So are we, when you look at following up on this material and these findings, will you also be trying to determine why physicians are feeling the need to admit residents more often from contracted care homes than the care homes that are dealt with by the owned and operated sites? And that's my first question. The second one is on the ALC side. Anybody who has already got a care home bed and has been transferred from a care home should never be coded as ALC, because that means they're waiting for something else. And the third thing is the devil's advocate question, and I would love you to end on this. We've made an assumption, I think, throughout the analysis that the admissions that were not made from owned and operated sites, so a decision not to admit from an owned and operated site, is a good decision. Has anyone taken a look at whether some of the deaths that occurred in the owned and operated sites should, in fact, and did warrant an admission to hospital? It's the other side of the coin, and I've worked on this in a previous life, looking at these people who should have been admitted and were not. So that's the end of my question.
Okay, Sue. So, pardon me?
And thanks again, Isabel. You've borne with me a lot this week.
Okay, no, that's fine. And I know, lucky you get to go on a plane. I don't. But in any event, I'm going to try to answer some of this. I think I've got it right. So, the decision around the physician. So, Sue, part of what drove this, and I think that actually Bob highlighted it in his earlier comments, where the care home will say, we can't take that resident, we can't care for them, we don't have the resources. And that is part of the frustration that the emergency department nurses and physicians that I met with were expressing, is that they felt, whether they're right or wrong, and that was the one of the catalysts for this study, that the care homes actually could and should be accepting the residents back because they were funded nursing care homes, that there is 24-hour nursing care provided there, and that this could be dealt with within that environment. And so while you say it's the physician's decision, it's not just the physician. That's only part of it. As you know, the other part of it is the care facility who will say, no, I can't accept that patient back. No, I can't care for them, and sort of trying to tease that out. I recognize that that's going to be a very heated kind of discussion to have, but I think we have to recognize that there are the two sides to that. The question about the other side of the coin, that's a very good question. You know, so this is focusing on people that were sent to the hospital that shouldn't have been. What about the people who should have gone to the hospital and didn't? That's a very valid question. The challenge is we have no way of studying that because you, unless you're going to start looking retrospectively at death data, you cannot start to approach this. That's not to dismiss that it isn't a valid question. I think what, again, what this is following is what is growing, becoming the growing concurrence in the clinical community and in the long-term care academic community and epidemiological community is that there are the transfer to and hospitalization of frail seniors is often more deleterious than if they had been able to be treated in the care facility. And certainly getting back to the end-of-life care. And are we doing that appropriately? So, you know, getting back to the, well, how do you know the trip to the emergency department was unnecessary if they ended up being admitted? And that's a valid point. Except this is where the results of this study became most compelling for me, Sue, was the consistency of a pattern. So it wasn't just more went to the emergency department, they were hospitalized, they had shorter lengths of stay. It was even if they didn't go through necessarily the emergency department, the overall hospitalization, the length of stay, because you have to remember that we have in these models, we've corrected for all the potential variables that explain it, like the acuity of the resident. That's catching it to some extent. We've treated the pool of residents in this modeling. We've created this vast, vast pool, these 50,000 residents, and we've equalized them in every way except whether they're in a contracted site or a health authority-owned site. And you either believe in the law of large numbers and you either believe in the statistical tools we used and you believe in the kinds of same methodologies that have linked cigarette smoking to cancer, or you don't at the end of the day. And people have their right to argue, and I respect that. But I am in the group of people who trust the science on this. And science is never perfect. And that's one of the reasons why you take comfort from large data sets. And that's what we have here. So, again, there's no answer I can give. It's become very apparent to me in the last month that's going to satisfy everybody out there. But I don't have a bias in this. And my only job is to look at what is in the best interest of seniors. And I stand by the results of this study. As inconclusive as the reasons are, I stand by the pattern that exists and that we have to find the reasons.
Thank you very much. There are no more questions on the queue.
Well, I want to, first of all, I really want to thank Kim and Jeff, not just obviously for the study, but for coming here today. And I really want to thank those of you who joined the call. I apologize for technical glitches that had us revert back to the old technology of making you advance your own slides. I would encourage, if any of you still have questions and queries, to contact me directly. I will respond and I will link you up with Kim or Jeff around some of the really technical issues around the data. I know a certain level, but at some point my eyes glaze over and I have to turn it over to Dr. Poss. But thank you all very much, and I look forward to working with all of the care home operators as we find more information and try to see how it is that we can work both in the public and the private. So I know there's some of the public sector colleagues out there as well. And, you know, there are some public sector facilities that probably can learn best practices maybe from some of the better performing private or contracted sites as well. And that's what this journey is about. It's about working together to find the best practices, the solutions, and look at how we can adjust these numbers. So thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes the Welcome to the Office of the Seniors Advocate Conference Call. Thank you for your participation and have a nice day.